Indeed. Right, hello everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to this debate, War on Plastic, a Load of Rubbish. It's the fourth debate in this strand, whose business is it anyway? My name's Rob Lyons, I'm the Science and Technology Director of the Academy of Ideas. We'd like to thank Pagefield as our partners for this strand and indeed for the conference as a whole. So, ever since David Attenborough's Blue Planet 2, which you may have noticed, the issue of plastic has been right to the fore of British politics. Every media outlet under the sun seems to be running a campaign about it or offering tips on how you can get over your addiction to plastic. Bans, restrictions and taxes on using plastic have been proliferating worldwide in recent years. But interest in dealing with plastic pollution is not merely a political or media concern. For many people, cutting down on plastics or helping with beach clear-ups is a practical way for them to do their bit for the environment. And school projects use the issue of plastics and recycling more generally to inculcate a sense of global citizenship. But plastics are also enormously useful and cheap to produce. So it's no wonder that they've become ubiquitous in modern life. So would cutting the use of plastics bring benefits or new problems? Is it time to rethink the role of plastics today? I'm delighted to be chairing this debate. I'm very, very interested in this issue, and I'm delighted that we've got such a good panel of speakers to discuss it. So I'll introduce them all briefly, ask them to speak for 5, 6, maybe 7 minutes, outlining their thoughts, and then I'll open the floor to you. So, on my immediate right is Helen Scales. She's a marine biologist, broadcaster, and author. She writes books about the oceans and the living planet, including Spirals in Time, which was shortlisted for the Royal Society of Biology Book Prize and picked as a Book of the Year by The Economist, The Times, Nature and The Guardian, and was BBC Radio 4's Book of the Week. Her latest book, Eye of the Shoal, explores the wonders of fish. A familiar voice for the environment, Helen presents the Earth Unscrewed podcast and appears regularly on BBC Radio. She teaches at Cambridge University and is a scientific advisor to the ocean conservation charity, Sea Changes. Then on far left is James Woodhouse. He's a visiting professor of forecasting and innovation at London South Bank University, an all-round watcher of trends in technology and economics. He has written for The Economist and The Times and contributes frequently to Radio 4 and Spike. He's co-author of Energize, A Future for Energy Innovation, editor of Big Potatoes, the London Manifesto for Innovation, and co-editor of the Wiley Handbook of Design and Innovation, Trends, Scenarios and Recommendations for 2030 and Beyond. Then on my immediate left is Libby Peake. She's a senior policy advisor on resource stewardship at Green Alliance, a UK-based independent charity and think tank. Green Alliance works with businesses, academics, NGOs and government to stimulate new environmental thinking and sustainable policy solutions. This includes convening the Circular Economy Task Force, a forum for policy, innovation and business thinking on efficient resource use in the UK. Before joining the Green Alliance, Libby spent 10 years at Resource Media, an environmental publishing house that promotes the use of waste as a resource. And finally, on my far right is Dominic Standish. Dominic is author of Venice in Peril, Myth and Reality. He wrote monthly for the Italy Daily section of the International Herald Tribune for 2 years, and has written frequent art features for the Italian news agency, ANSA. Just one of the many media outlets he's written for. Dominic holds a PhD in Sociology and Risk from the University of Kent, and lectures for the University of Iowa, USA. Dominic is also the producer of this session. As I said to another session earlier in the festival, the Battle of Ideas spirit is, if you're really obsessed with a subject and you think you'd make a good debate, suggest it to us and produce it. And that's exactly what Dominic's done. And so I'm very grateful he's done that, because, it's, as I said, I'm fascinated by this issue. So, without any further ado, I would say hello.
Thank you very much. I can remember very clearly when I personally had my eyes open to the issue of plastic pollution and just how bad it was. It was a few years ago. I was living in Senegal in West Africa, in the capital city, Dakar. And every morning before I start work, I would go surfing. And I very quickly had to get used to the sensation of swimming in a soup of plastic. There was plastic bits in the water all around me. I remember at first, when I first started surfing here, I would see something colourful moving in the water and I'd think, oh, it's a jellyfish. But then take a second look and realise it was a plastic bag. There were days when several times hands I had to unknot pieces of plastic that literally tied themselves around my leash, the cord you tie your surfboard to your leg with. I think the most shocking thing was that after a couple of months I got so used to this that I would see a piece of colourful something moving in the water and I'd think, ah, it's a plastic bag. But I would take a second look and realise it sometimes was actually a jellyfish. But my thinking had really changed. So that's when it really sunk in for me. And I think it also reflects something particular about this issue of plastic pollution. And I think maybe it explains partly why we have got so much attention to it right now. And that's that we can see it. It's really obviously there. It's a very visual and very visceral thing to see a part of the natural world polluted with plastic. You don't have to go to the other side of the world to see it. You don't have to go to the Amazon or the Great Barrier Reef. I was in West Africa, but you can easily see plastic pollution here at home. And, you know, I think that's, I genuinely think that's partly why it has really kind of captured people's imaginations. It's easy to make that link. It's not like an invisible gas. This is stuff you can see, and I don't think there's really any way you can deny that plastic is out there. I don't know if there are any plastic skeptics out there, but I think it's much less likely. I do personally think that if we're going to solve this issue, we do need radical change, and we need it fast. And I do think that small incremental steps are not going to get us there. So I think it's really carefully important that we think really carefully about what kind of solutions we are going to take to this issue of plastic pollution. And we can be kind of led astray. McDonald's recently were kind of given a green tick for saying they're going to stop using plastic straws. But then it's like, well, yeah, but the plastic straws go through a plastic lid in the drink. So we're not thinking big enough on that one. Putting my science hat on, just briefly, I would say that we don't really need to spend any more money and time going out looking for plastic. We've got that one pretty much sorted. Like, is there plastic out there? The answer is yes. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's from the tops of mountains to the deepest ocean to the Arctic sea ice. It's everywhere. We've got that. We know it's a big scale thing. The questions we don't have answers for, there's two in particular. One is we don't really understand the ecological impact of plastics yet. Sure, we've got some studies of individual species, individual animals, that they might eat plastic, get tangled in it. Those problems we're beginning to get a grip with. But how is it filtering through the ecosystem? This complex system of species eating species, interacting with this plastic world, we don't yet fully understand that. Certainly not compared to our understanding of, say, overfishing or climate change. We've got a better handle on the ecological impact of those things. The other thing we don't yet have an answer for is the human health question. Obviously, that's the one a lot of people are worrying about and are really concerned about, and that's very understandable. But we just don't know. We don't know the impact of interacting with plastic on our daily lives. It's in our food, in the water we drink, the air that we breathe, it's everywhere. But we just don't yet have a clear picture of how much it's affecting us. And these studies, the ecological ones and the human health ones, they're not going to be answered quickly. These are complex systems. We can't go around feeding people different doses of plastic and see what kind of health impacts there are. It's going to take a while for those answers to come along. But I would argue that we don't need those answers before we take action. We really need to get going now on those radical changes to the way we're doing things. You know, we've got this picture of how much plastic is out there. We need to do something about it now. And I guess it kind of leads me to one of the criticisms that's laid down on the plastic pollution campaigns. So we've got so much coverage and so much attention being paid on it. One of the criticisms is that it's diverting attention away from other impacts, other environmental problems that perhaps could be seen as being more important. So climate change being an obvious example of that. Now, this is something that's really kind of made me think, and I've been thinking about this for quite a while. In particular, I have been concerned about what happens if the issue of plastic fades from people's minds and we'll just go back to normal. What happens next? But actually, on reflection, maybe I don't believe that this is a distraction. And in fact, maybe what it's doing, because of this visual nature of the plastic, it isn't going to go away anytime soon. We are going to keep seeing this stuff. And it has, I think, created more environmentalists than other issues. I think people are engaging with this visual issue and thinking more about what they're doing and looking to places like the oceans more than we have before. So I think maybe this is a good time because it is creating more awareness more broadly. And I just want to finish with a quote from Hugo Tancock. He's the guy who heads up Surfers Against Sewage. It's a charity, I think, that runs various issues in ocean pollution, but plastics has been their focus lately. He sent out this tweet, I think, last week, and it kind of sums up, I think, how I'm, the hopeful side of me feels about the plastic issue and public awareness. And he says, plastic pollution is a gateway issue for all of us to make more radical, to take more radical action on climate change, habitat depletion, resource consumption, and the rampant clear-cutting of our natural world and oceans. It doesn't end at plastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Very well expressed, thanks to time as well. Well done. James?
Well, I want to say that standing back from plastics for a moment, it's a remarkable fact that our view of plastics has always reflected what we think about ourselves. It's not just a physics question or a chemistry question or an ecological question, but from Bakelite in the 1890s and through to the 30s, to the magic moment in when Dustin Hoffman is greeted with the idea that plastics are the future, in that famous film whose name I'd rather forget, The Graduate in the 60s, The Graduate by Mike Nichols, there had been upbeat moments with plastic when it didn't connote made in Hong Kong, say in the 50s, and was going to fall apart right away. And now we're hitting a really negative moment. So standing back from it all, we have to recognise that plastics, perhaps much more than steel or other materials, is a bit of a cultural phenomenon. Our views on it have wavered between seeing it as a force for progress and seeing it as a force for doom. The same thing we need to remember in all of this is I'm very much with what Helen said about radical steps are needed. I was a bit surprised to hear from you, Helen, maybe I misunderstood you, that you know, the great thing about plastics is it's going to be around for a long time to remember us, remind us how awful we all are. Now, that there I'm introducing you, forgive me, it's late at the Battle of Ideas. But let me understand, are you saying it's a good thing that it's around so nobody can be a plastic skeptic? Because I agree that it's around. But I think it's quite interesting that you are worried that it might distract from other ecological issues like climate change. I think climate change is on the back burner now, despite the IPCC report. I'm afraid that fracking is also on the back burner now. But we have, at least with plastics, a chance for the green movement to make up some lost ground. That doesn't do it for me. I think what's more important is that we consider society's need, when they're thinking of radical solutions, for whole new industries. Whole new industries better than cyber security that can prepare lots and lots of high-paying, high-tech jobs. And one of those industries, ladies and gentlemen, is what I would call, and did call in the Energize book, a new carbon infrastructure. It's not as fake ambitious as a new carbon economy. But if we're serious about the industrial recycling, industrial scale recycling of carbon that is needed, grabbing it from the atmosphere and lowering climate change by capturing the carbon dioxide there, taking it from our coal plants, being able to recycle it pneumatically on a home-by-home basis where we do not have to do what my 92-year-old mother does every Sunday, which is a labour-intensive recycling in her front garden. It takes 40 minutes for a 92-year-old, and it's still unclear what you put in what plastics really be. That is not an automated solution, such as we need at homes. We need much more machine recognition of the plastics and the waste that we're doing at a local authority, at a national level. Then we need to take every other measure to try to reduce the impact of plastics without going on a personal guilt trip, because it's a wonderful material and it isn't individuals' fault that it is causing the promise, the problems that it is. If you'll allow me a trick tune, train throw French crows do it, US UK double mutant petes, an aromatic polyesterase with specially engineered surfaces, depolymerizes it, Pakistani fungi enzymes digest it. And four young Dutch inventor, Boyan Slat, has already met with green diatribes for daring to scoop it up from the Pacific with his boat. Didn't do the whole, you know, birds do it, and all of that. Thank God for that. But we've already got crows, we've got enzymes, we've got fungi, we've got boats in the Pacific, which of course a terrible idea because it would distract from individual responsibility for plastics. We've got recycling machines in Istanbul tube stations to take back your plastics and give you a fare to go somewhere else in Istanbul. So we've got a lot of automated methods of recovering the waste, and what we need is a whole new industry to do that on a much larger scale to make carbon, to make the best use of carbon, which is a miracle material. Now, some of you, hands up those green-leaning people here who would like a zero carbon economy. Hands up. Great. Well, you've just committed suicide because you're 18% carbon. No, we're all of that. And therefore, you know, if you read Primo Levi, the periodic table, carbon, fantastic stuff. Right? And when we're so obsessively concerned with plastic, right now, I agree, Alan, it's available. You can get it even in the UK. You can't deny it. But you and I know that most of the source of it is in the Ganges, is in the Mekong Delta, it's in what used to be called the Third World, underdeveloped or reputedly now developing nations like India and China, but also the whole of Southeast Asia. That's where it mainly enters the sea, and that's where we need automated devices to capture it, to filter it, and not to make us feel guilty about it here in Britain. We need what are often derided by Greens, technological fixes, rather than individual guilt trips. So let's work together with the best marine biologists and the progressive Greens to actually solve the problem, not be hysterical about it. And remember, it should never be allowed to distract not just from other ecological problems, but what is happening to the developing countries and how we are imposing our waste solutions upon them in a really undemocratic manner, and how they are, in their failure to develop, in Southeast Asia in particular, and also much China, but also in India, they have the problems that they do. So it's a political question, not just a cultural. But we can solve it, and we do need the radical steps that Alan recommended.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I've got a lot to say in response to that, but I think I'll mainly stick to what I was planning on saying. But just start by sort of showing that there really is a problem, because there are 8 million tons of plastics that are getting into the ocean every year. And by some estimates, there's going to be more plastic in the ocean by weight than fish by 2050. And I think we have to remember that most of the plastic that gets into the ocean sinks. So although inspiring people like Boyan Sat, who's a Dutch boy who's come along and created something that will scoop up some of the larger bits of plastic, I mean, that's great. That is something that needs to be done, but that's not going to solve the problem. Also, I think it's worth remembering that two-thirds of the plastics that we collect for recycling in the UK, which is actually just a third of plastics in total that get collected for recycling, those go out to places like India and Malaysia and Indonesia, where some of the plastics that we're creating are going to go into the sea. And when they get into the sea, we know that they're a real problem. There's at least 130 species of marine animals that are ingesting them, and at least 250 that are struggling with entanglement. And there's, 250 that ingest it and 130 that are struggling with entanglement. The other species that ingest it, humans are one of them. And so this is a real problem that we definitely need to solve. But I think maybe James will be happy to hear what I intend to focus on mainly, which is a cautionary tale about the invention of plastic. The invention of plastic actually happened in response to an environmental crisis. And I think that's something that we really need to think of now as we're trying to find the solution to this environmental crisis. So in the late 1800s, the world was facing, was nearly pushing elephants to the brink of extinction. And it all came down to our love of billiards. At least 2 elephants had to be killed for every set of billiard balls that was made. And that became a real problem when billiards moved out of the homes, the upper class parlour homes in the UK, and became really popular in the saloons of America, because it just wasn't sustainable. We couldn't kill enough elephants to meet the world's demand for ivory. And so the world needed a solution to this environment.
environmental crisis, and one man in particular was very concerned about it. He was called Michael Sullen, who's the father of American billiards. And in part because elephants were about to go extinct, but probably mainly because ivory was getting quite expensive as elephants were getting scarcer, he wanted a substitute for plastic. And so he put out an ad saying that you could get $10,000, which is roughly equivalent to $200,000 today, if you invented the substitute for ivory. And there was a young German printer called John Wesley Hyatt who started experimenting with various solvents. And after about 6 years, he stumbled upon celluloid, which is the first industrial plastic. And that quickly changed the entire world. It wasn't actually the greatest substitute for ivory and billiard balls because it had a nasty habit of exploding when the two balls hit each other. But because plastic is such a useful and durable and moldable and flexible material, it quickly became ubiquitous. I think we clearly overdid it, though. Something that the statistic for the amount of ivory that was unsustainable in the 1800s is £1 million a year. That was the global market for ivory. We're now producing 300 million tons of plastic, which is 660,000 times as much ivory as is unsustainable. Now, obviously, we've replaced a lot of other things, but we've also created a lot more material in the process. And it's probably worth noting that despite all the concern about plastics, the plastics industry is still expecting a threefold increase in the amount of material that they're going to produce by 2050. Now, I don't think that it's up to individual people to solve the problem, but I do think that we need to take caution from this tale of people rushing to the solution to find a substitute for ivory and billiard balls. There's a great 1878 sales pamphlet for celluloid, which reads, "As petroleum came to the relief of the whale, so has celluloid given the elephant, the tortoise, and the coral insect a respite in their native ponds. And it will no longer be necessary to ransack the earth in pursuit of substances which are constantly growing scarcer." So the three animals that are listed there, the elephant, the tortoise, and the coral insect, they're all now being killed by plastic, which was originally meant to save them. So I think as we're looking for the next solution, we need to think really carefully about the proposals that we're putting forward. And a lot of people are quickly reaching for substitutes, things like composite materials, low-quality composite materials, which are difficult to recycle, replacing plastic with glass, which is much heavier to transport and has much greater carbon impact, and bioplastics, which have various issues, including the fact that they're not going to degrade in the ocean, so they're not going to solve the problem anyway. So I think that in answer to the titular question, is the war on plastics a load of rubbish? No, it absolutely isn't. We need to be waging this war, but if we're not careful in how we're doing it, we're going to wind up with a lot of other wars on our hands.
Okay, thank you very much. Dominic. Okay, so after seeing plastics in the ocean from Venice to Indonesia, I started researching how plastics get into the oceans, and they get into the oceans in multiple ways, through litter, wind blowing plastics into rivers and oceans, from shipping, there's certainly a problem with discarded fishing nets. However, several studies around the world, which are well published, and two of which are on the website for this reading list, point to the fact that the overwhelming source of plastics getting into the ocean are 10 rivers in the world. 8 of them are in Asia and 2 of them in Africa. Indeed, one of the studies on the website estimates that between 88 and 95% of the plastics that gets into the ocean does so from those 10 rivers. Now, why is that important? Firstly, because those parts of the world are areas which are very undeveloped and have poor waste management systems. So I think there's an argument there for development and improving waste management systems. I agree with James about that. Where I disagree with James is that the problem can be resolved in Asia and Africa. Because actually, if we look at the source of a lot of those plastics, they are being exported from the EU, the US, Japan and Australia to those parts of the world. It was previously China that was overwhelmingly importing plastics for so-called recycling. However, that has now shifted because since the beginning of this year, China has banned the import of 24 types of different waste, including plastics. And increasingly now those plastics are going to countries like Vietnam, Malaysia and Indonesia that used to do a lot of the sorting of plastics before they went to be recycled in China. So the problem's become displaced. However, the EU has been historically the largest exporter of plastics to China with 3 million tonnes a year. UK exports of plastic have doubled in the last decade. And what is happening to a lot of those plastics? When you read through the literature on plastics, we realise that it's a very big business. The EU, other countries and governments need to meet targets on recycling. Some of those plastics are directly being dumped in the sea to avoid docking and landfill fees. Some of those plastics are being burnt in the open air. And it's estimated that just in China, 20% of plastics exported to China end up in the sea. So I think we have a real problem within the developed world, and particularly if we focus on Europe, given that's where we all are, given that Europe is the main exporter of plastics in the world. If we look at European policy, by 2030, all EU plastic packaging will have to be recycled or reused according to EU legislation. By 2030, only 10% of municipal waste will be able to go into landfill. That's all pushing further towards recycling and further towards the exporting of recycled plastics. The EU also, in its 2000 Waste Directive, placed restrictions on incinerating plastic. And I agree with Helen that we need radical solutions for the plastic problem. And indeed, I think incineration needs to be a big part of the problem, a big part of the solution within the developed world. There are 7 European countries which have very developed incineration facilities. Incineration incinerates everything. Okay? Unlike recycling plants, which don't recycle all the plastic they receive, including sewage sludge, which comes out of recycling plants and is a main contributor of plastics getting into the ocean. Incineration can also be used to capture heat and generate electricity. It contributes very, very little to greenhouse gases. The outcome of incineration is ash, very, very small amounts of ash, which can also be recycled and used in road building. So I think incineration within European and developed societies, instead of exporting more and more to societies where it ends up in the ocean, should be part of the solution. However, unfortunately, EU policy is pushing us in the opposite direction. James mentioned the practice of recycling. Can you just imagine, instead of those trucks coming 3 times a week to pick up those different bags, you put out one bag, one truck comes a week, and it's incinerated. Now, I'm not saying it will be the same solution for every society, and I think landfill should still play an important part. It will vary from country to country. But since the ban placed by China at the beginning of this year, we've seen the piling up of plastics. We're seeing countries like the Netherlands, which have very good incineration facilities, being overwhelmed by demands on incineration. So I would like to see incineration and landfill away from rivers and oceans as part of the solution.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. There's plenty of disagreement on the panel. I'm sure they're itching to come back on each other's points, but I'm not going to let them just yet. I'm going to take a few points from the floor to get the debate going. So I see a hand here. Any other hands? Way on the back. Thank you. Yeah.
I haven't been in Britain for most of the last 5 years. I've been living in Germany where they have a banned bottle scheme, which they've had for 20 more years, where you basically PET bottles and aluminium cans and glass bottles go back to be recycled in the supermarkets or the shops where you bought them. This is all over Germany, and when you get your money back, you go shopping, buying this stuff. Our supermarkets argue for that it prevents damage to transport, but actually creates greater problems through rotting of the food. I used to go and buy vegetables, you know, you just have one bag, which could be made out of plastic, and recycled bottles for that matter. They exist in other countries, and you too.
It is partly a regulatory war, it's certainly a media war,
And the whole focus is in it, and it is, you are a wastrel, you are a working class thug who's tucked away, you know, threw away his plastic, you know, in a totally inconsiderate way. You probably voted Brexit as well. You know, get out of here. Now, you might make the point that the decline of left-wing traditions in this country is responsible for a lot of the plastic and non-plastic waste on our street. There was a moment, without romanticising it, where you get a cuff around the ears in a mining town if you did anything like that. But of course, we can't cuff children around the ears because that's also regulated nowadays. So there is a litter problem, not just plastic, but bigger than that. And it's always a political problem. Now, I didn't mention another technological fix, which I'd like Lydia and Helen to come back on, which is presumably you're in favour of robots, although we should be against them because they're already taking our jobs in every tapas bar I visit. But maybe we could have a few robots on our beaches. Impossible? Well, the military are very good at it, with, you know, dealing with improvised explosive devices, IED. So forward with robots, we shall fight the plastics on our beaches with robots. Can somebody say that? And, you know, that's what I want to see. And then I want to know whether you are in favour of the BBC, Chuck Sky's relentless campaign to do to guilt us out. Just to conclude, material science, I think the key thing there is that we do need better substitutes for the existing plastics, and there are defects to the alternatives that you outlined, Vivian. And we need more chemical science, we need more material science, we need more research and development, and we need maybe a government minister who even knew what materials was, because they don't know anything about that stuff, they just know about Westminster. So the fight for alternatives to plastics, like robots and specially trained French crows that will pick it up from your local park, which is what they've done in France, all of those scientific and technological techniques is something we need to foreground, and we need to take a relentless stance against people telling us how to live our lives.
Okay, Libby.
Thank you. Just to be clear, I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to replace billion volts with plastic. The problem is the fact that it's now getting into the ocean, which is affecting everyone. I think one of the problems that hasn't really been discussed is that when plastic gets into the ocean, it breaks down. It doesn't biodegrade, but it breaks down into ever tinier pieces, which makes it really hard to collect once it's got into the ocean. So one of the solutions you're going to have should be things that happen at the front end. So you really need to think a lot more carefully about design. We should not be designing so many different types of plastic that make it impossible to recycle. If we had only a few different types of polymers, it would be much easier to make the economics of recycling stack up. I think you also definitely need to reduce the use of plastics in general. You need to reduce the presence of hazardous chemicals in plastics, because there are a lot of those as well. And then when you're left with whatever is left over, then you should recycle those. In terms of the gentleman's questions about the drawbacks of incineration, at the moment, the comparative technology that people use when they're talking about incineration in terms of greenhouse gases is a combined cycle gas generation, which is quite equal for incineration and combined cycle gas turbines. But as the grid decarbonizes, incineration quickly becomes one of the most carbon intense forms of energy generation. When you're looking at plastic in particular, there are arguments that some green groups have put forward that it's much better to put it in the ground, because then it acts as a carbon sink, and you're not releasing any of those materials, any of that fossil fuel which went into making those plastics. And then there's also arguments about locking in to waste generation. So when you build an incinerator, they tend to be quite large, and they need to be fed a very high amount of material in order to be efficient throughout their lifetime, and they last for about 30 years. So we're going to be committed to generating that waste. One other argument would be the solution would be to reduce that waste in the first place, so that you don't have to rely on that technology. And then just in terms of the deposit return scheme that you asked, we've not had very much direction from government in recent years, but the government will next month be launching its first resources and waste strategy in 11 years, and they have promised to institute a deposit and 2020. That is something that could go wrong or it could go right. It is quite a complicated thing, but there is movement in that area.
Okay, thank you very much, Helen.
So I want to make a couple of points. I think it's really interesting to talk about how different people respond to this idea of being told what to do. I think a lot of us maybe suffer from the kind of echo chamber effect that, I know a lot of people who are very much behind the idea of reducing plastic use and doing what they can, but obviously that's not everybody, and the idea of getting pissed off because you're told what to do, what not to do, it's a really important part of this whole question of how any change is going to happen. If we do agree that this is an issue that is eventually going to be kind of need fixing, then obviously we need to find that solution that's going to work for everybody. So James, I really enjoyed your ideas about these kind of technological fixes. There are those who would certainly shy away from relying on kind of techno-fixing our way out of all of the environmental problems we have right now, climate change, switch plastic and so on. Robots on a beach, sure, if that works, why not? I also think there are loads of people who seem to really enjoy a day out doing a beach clean, and that's brought communities together. So for those people, that is working. It doesn't work for everyone. We don't all want to have to go and do that. But I assume that you're kind of talking about circular economies or a circular infrastructure, and that's something that can change from above. Each of us as individuals aren't going to necessarily kind of push into that. I guess the point I want to make is, does the guilt tripping, whatever you want to put it, however you want to frame it, are there enough people responding positively to that to help push for the bigger change that we need from the top in terms of bigger regulations? Not being told what you can do, but the fact that you could just one day walk into a supermarket and you won't have to just buy lettuces wrapped in plastic because they won't be there anymore, because enough people said we don't want it, we found a solution to it. So whatever anyone thinks of that, it's not me telling you to not buy that, it's just they're not going to be there. Just, can we get to that kind of solution through enough people who do want that to change and do want to sort of see positive decisions? The other point I want to make is the positive messages aren't difficult to get with plastic. I think with a lot of environmental solution problems, it is difficult to say, anything other than it's all really terrible. I mean, personally, I struggle with this on a daily basis. I write books mostly. I make a few radio programs about the environment. I want people to engage and have a sense of wonder about all of this. And I do want you to know that there are problems too, but I don't want that to get in the way. So I've just written a book about fish, and I quite clearly said at the beginning, it was more kind of a biology book about how awesome these animals are, and they get up to stuff you never imagined, because I want people to engage with these animals more than we do, because you don't see them. They're always hidden in the water, they're not like birds that fly around, whatever. But I've already had two people criticise my books, two reviews, saying, yeah, but she didn't talk about overfishing. And I laid out at the beginning, well, this is not a book about the problems, it's just a book about how cool these animals are. We can talk about overfishing if you want, but that's not what I'm here. I think maybe the thing that's happened with people like David Attenborough is they were doing all the wonderful wow stuff for years and years and years, and he's just started talking about the problems and maybe isn't offering enough solutions other than you guys have to stop. It's all up to us as individuals to make those choices. And I think the nuanced sort of solutions are being offered up perhaps in those sorts of programs. They're showing the problems really clearly. We're getting that picture. If you saw Drowning in Plastic by Liz Bonin a couple of weeks ago, you come away from that being thoroughly demoralised about the whole thing, pretty much. There are some solutions out there, but we still feel guilty. And that's just still the thing that's happening. So maybe that's what needs to change as well, those other messages. Besides, the kid who's got his $30 million project to scoop plastic out of the Pacific, how should we respond as individuals? Can we change that discourse as well?
Okay, Donald.
Okay, just on the question at the front here about EU policy restricting incineration, I think it's about a perception that it adds to greenhouse gases, and actually it adds an absolutely minuscule amount compared with power generation, flying, if you'll excuse the pun, it's a drop in the ocean. And obviously there are lots of green groups, including Greenpeace, that have campaigned against incineration in the country where I live in Italy. There was a big campaign in the 1990s in the Campania region to stop incineration. The rubbish piled up. To cut a long story short, people started burning it. They sent the army in to clear it up, and it all got exported to be incinerated. So there is obviously a history of green groups campaigning against incineration. So that's an issue. I agree with Libby that incineration incineration requires huge amounts of plastic to be burnt, but there's plenty there and it's piling up, so I don't see that as being a problem. Robots on the beach, I'm not entirely against you on this one, James, but I don't see that as a big part of a practical solution. I was listening on Radio 4 the other day to some people on the Isle of Wight talking about their beach cleans. It was interesting to hear them say that sometimes they're very frustrated that they go down to the beach and they can't find any plastics. It was interesting to hear them say that sometimes they go down and they do find some plastics and then people walk past them and say, well done, and they say, yes, and why aren't you helping us? If people want to do that, that's fine, but I think a lot of that is about kind of moral posturing. I think there's also a thing about plastics, particularly the microplastics discussion, that it's something we can't see, and it's like the kind of new devil, and we're all going to feel very guilty about our kind of relationship with plastics. I read a very interesting study in Indonesia which examined the diets of thousands of Indonesians, and obviously Indonesia is a country where generally there's a very high level of fish in the diet, and secondly it's one of those parts of the world where there's a lot of plastic. They examined the microplastic impacts, and this was published by the BBC, and they found no negative impact of microplastics on people's diets. They found the microplastic in there, but no negative health impacts. So again, as Helen said at the beginning, it's there. We often can't see it. Is it the kind of new depth of humanity that we're kind of feeling guilty about, and it's kind of drifting around, and therefore we need to kind of cleanse our souls by walking around the beach on a Saturday morning?
Okay. You just made me think of a little factoid, or fact, that I discovered about a year ago in relation to your point about incineration, but it's not actually incineration. In Britain, we have renewable energy statistics, and it's like there's winds this, and then solar's this, and biomass, in fact, the biggest thing is biomass. And 9% of Britain's renewable, it's called renewable energy, comes from landfill gas. Rotting stuff in landfills that the gas is collected, and that's called renewable. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in. Anyway, as a surprise, it's not as good as the celluloid bill of the balls. I'm admitting that now. Right, so we're going to go whiz down this way. So it's going to be past the parcel back. So start at the front, and we're going to go backwards. Yes, so this thing here, and then you can pass it back.
Thank you very much, Olivia. I just wanted to hear from the panel about three things. In terms of the solution, I think we're hearing quite a lot in favor of technology, but one of the good things I feel actually with plastic, it has brought home again the human responsibility. Probably one of the reasons why climate change hasn't had the same, or at least not as much as it could with plastic, and I think there's a lot of underplaying in terms of what humans and what us as individuals can do. The other thing I wanted to hear about from the panel is the fact that a lot of the plastics we have are actually made from fossil fuels. So that is a problem in itself because we're trying to reduce reliance on fossil fuels. And the third thing is the wonderful material, as you described it, PJ. If you read that wonderful material, it actually interacts with us in ways we don't yet know in terms of with our hormones. We recently heard that it's impacting on killer whales and the production of that species. So to say the back of the statement from what I heard just recently that well actually the impact on human health, I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, just pass that straight behind.
Thanks. It's interesting listening to people because we talk about regulation, and I thought there's some great points made around sort of how we can change human behaviour. And it strikes me it's just really bloody difficult to know what you can do about it first, because you're confronted and you're in a supermarket with those plastics, you don't have a choice. The second thing is when it comes to recycling, it's a complex, challenging issue that doesn't make it easy for us. So we have different bins for different things. In some locations, there are some coffee cups you can recycle, others you can't. At home, I've got one big bin that covers every recycling thing I can imagine. I'm not quite sure what belongs in there and what doesn't. So it seems to me, like the lady there was talking about what happens in Germany, I've seen that. Even if you're not a bar of the environment, it's easier for you to take it back to the shop and get some money than it is to just chuck it away. And I think it seems to me that fighting at changing technology and mopping in apartments is one thing, but we have to make it easier for people and not kind of lecture them or patronise them or sort of tell them what to do. That's just making it simple and easy for people to do the right thing and help people understand. want to, you know, clearly if we're producing loads of this stuff, that isn't obviously going to naturally deteriorate its own core in a good way, then we ought to just find new ways to make it easier for people to do the right thing. But at the moment, they don't know what the right thing is, and we make it really, really hard.
Okay, again, behind you.
So I'm interested to hear a bit more about the whole gateway issue of plastics. So personally for me, plastics and awareness are going to be a great way about, you know, changing other ways I interact with the environment. But for a lot of friends, you know, refusing straws, you know, they've done that, but they're still eating meat twice a day, you know, mass farming, all this is engaging with fast fashion, which now becoming more of an issue. So I'd kind of be interested to see whether you see actual plastic as a really great education for people and getting them more involved in the environment, or whether actually they're just doing that little bit and kind of topping up everything else, because plastic is such a major issue and it's turning a lot of us into engaging at another level.
Okay. Oh, sorry, that was a hand there. Yeah, I'm going to whiz backwards, I promise.
I'm very sad that the local government doesn't exist in many places anymore. I stopped working in 2016. Now, I do wonder, is it possible to produce plastics for milk bottles that could be reused rather than recycling? And reusing is always better than going through the process of recycling. And I would like my son wants to make my next we mentioned about taking things back to the shop and getting some money back. We were in Montreal last year. Do you want to say something? And then have a system web application, taking the plastic bottles back to the supermarket and have a machine which gives you money back. The unfortunate effect of that is that you put out the recycling vans and, you know, poor people, homeless people, take all the rubbish and it gets all scattered all over the
okay, thank you. Let's keep going back and say, oh yes, we've got jolly good, far away.
I'm just wondering, by looking at the technical solutions, which I think are interesting, we're actually got the problem the wrong way around, and I'd be quite interested to just clarify with the panel what the overall aim is here, because for me it would be about being able to have an expanding and growing population that has access to cheap quality goods that means that we can sustain more people healthier and we can enjoy as much food as possible. So that would be my starting points. The technical solutions then, to talk about the ones that individual places can really work with, I think, what do I know about this? So, reflecting on some of what you've been saying, I've just been thinking about some of the campaigns that have happened over, say, the last 20 years. And you think about the fact that it was a health scare that drove people to drinking water out of bottles, which we're still doing today, about quality of drinking water. If you think about the switch from petrol to diesel, I didn't say that. It wasn't me who said it, it was environmentalists. If you think about the current discussions about, so my point is rather going on, is I'm just saying, if you think about what underlies this, firstly, I'm not a scientist, and secondly, we need to deal with these things on an industrial scale. I cannot, doesn't matter what I do in terms of my recycling, I cannot solve this problem, because we're talking about a problem that's far bigger than us as individuals. And my final point is that on this, and it relates to that point, is I think all the discussion about putting this, therefore, on individual responsibility. The bigger problem is that leadership is avoiding being held accountable for the solutions in performance. And I think that the biggest metaphor for me is shifting our weight to the third world. I just think it's pretty disgusting. And if we can't develop technical solutions that begin to solve our problems by innovation, by investment, and all of these things, I just think that would be the biggest metaphor. We need to sort out our own shift.
Okay. And on your first point, it's a very good example in Liz Bonin's film. Many people see Liz Bonin's film. It was on a couple of weeks ago. And one of the problems in Indonesia's rivers is that something that's become very popular there for poorer people is buying stuff in sachets. They can't afford like a box of washing powder, but they can afford a little sachet of it, but then the sachets are made of plastic and they end up in the river. So how do you give people the material things that they need, solve that problem, while really interesting question. Yes, so turquoise striped shirt? Yeah.
Something about their plastic consumption or feels that they ought to in this room.
Wow.
Okay, interesting. It's having an impact then, is it? Who thinks it's it's nonsense and we shouldn't do anything at all? Okay. Remain. Right, okay, and on that happy note, I'm going to bring... alright, sorry, there's one more hand there and then I'll bring...
I just wanted to make a brief point. I think it's somewhat
unfair
to say that the ban on, or the restriction on incineration, largely driven by green concerns, has led to the export of plastics to the Far East and elsewhere, and then you've got an innovation. I think I know a rule to play.
Right, okay, I'm going to bring the panel back in. I'm going to do it the opposite way around. I'm going to start on my right with Dominic and work across the panel that way. How about that? So, Dominic, your final thoughts in about 3 minutes.
Okay, great final contribution there. I also just wanted to respond to the lady in the second row here who spoke about the lack of development and the desire to recycle. Recycling does sound very nice, doesn't it? Who could be opposed to it? But if you actually look at what happens in recycling plants, they are really awful places. So a couple of things about recycling plants. Firstly, only a third of the plastic that arrives in recycling plants gets recycled. Two-thirds of it still goes out to landfill, incineration, other things happen to it. It produces a lot of sludge that can end up in the oceans. It produces a lot of wastewater. It's very, very intensive use of water. And it requires an awful lot of labour because it's very difficult to automate. And indeed, it's very dirty, and a lot of gases are produced. It's a very bad environment to work in. So it's expensive, it's labour intensive, and it uses a lot of resources. And that is one reason why it's parts of the developing world that have been so concentrated on recycling plants. Because most people in developed societies don't want to work in those kinds of environments. So I would avoid the temptation to increase the recycling. On the question about why, I agreed with the gentleman who said that a lot of why we're talking about this is kind of anti-modern. Okay, so it follows the pattern of anti-car, anti-cruise ship, etc., etc. But I think it's also because, and this is a point I do agree with James on, that there's been a kind of come down on the climate change issue. But if you look at most surveys of concern about climate change, for example, in the UK, people are less concerned about it now than they were 5 years ago, despite the IPCC report. And something, you know, plastics are something which, you know, if you're environmentally concerned, it seems that you can do something about it. And in fact, you have to do something about it because the gentleman mentioned here we're being regulated and told what to do about it. So it appears to be something that you can do about the environment that's easier than changing power generation. So I think that's why we're here. I wonder if there will be a new fad in a couple of years' time and there'll be another kind of issue and we'll move on from the plastics. But I do think it is a serious problem. It's clearly undesirable to have plastics entering oceans, and that's why I think we need to look at a range of solutions from incineration to more landfill. There's also a lot of space for landfill, and landfill has really developed now. I mean, you have landfill sites under golf courses in America which are very, very well sealed, and you know, landfill doesn't sound nice either, but can be a very environmentally friendly solution.
Okay.
Lovely. Thanks for everyone's comments. Someone mentioned the sort of question over human health and whether we've kind of got that figured out yet. And again, I think I'll reiterate that we really don't have that sorted. So far, there's been no huge health scare. We don't know it's as bad as as asbestos, but that could still potentially come out. If you are interested in following this issue as it develops, look out in the news for any coverage of nanoplastics. We've got microplastics on the horizon as nanoplastics. And I could just, you know, we just don't know about that. These are even tiny bits of plastic that could get inside our cells and into our brains, which is hilariously fun. I mean, that could really be scary or not. We just don't know. So there is a huge question mark about that. Researchers will hopefully give us some answers soon. The question question about research development fund, the funding for that, and I absolutely agree that we should be able to figure out how to recycle plastics, make plastics and other products that can quite easily be reused at the end of their lives, and to think that whole system through. And there are people, really smart people, who are finding ways of getting money for that, to think clearly about the whole system, about what you do with a chair when it's broken at the end of the day, and you don't have to chuck it away, you just give it back to the guy who made it and they make another chair, those sorts of things. We are doing that, but more and more that does need to happen. And I'd just like to mention, I wrote a short piece on plastics for BBC Focus magazine, and in that I interviewed a guy called Richard Thompson from Plymouth University, who was one of the first guys to see that there was microplastics in the marine environment, tiny fragments on beaches. And he's very much now involved in research to look for solutions, not just pointing out the problems. And he said to me he thought it was a really exciting time, because right now we do have much more interest in plastic pollution than ever before. We've got this, whether you're on one side or the other, there are a lot of people on the side of being aware and caring about this. And industry and government are, to some extent, they are starting to respond to that. And he said what we need to do is we need to get interdisciplinary research to find solutions. So it isn't just talking to me as an ecologist. It's talking to me or other people like me. You need to bring in material scientists. You need to bring in behavioural scientists, which brings in my point about we need simple solutions to figure out how people will change their behaviours and whether or not this is the gateway. We don't actually know if it's a gateway. We just hope it is. But we need people who understand human behaviour to come in on those projects to sort of talk about, okay, well, you know, can we get people, you know, can we really be replacing plastic bags, straws, whatever it is? And all of those people talking together could come up with solutions that will work and that won't just be hectoring, you feel guilty about this, it's up to you, but really big radical change, which is what we need. So, and I guess my final point is, it does need to be simple in terms of recycling. I live in Cambridge and we have one big bin for recycling, and even then people just throw in stuff that clearly shouldn't be there, like chairs, you know, so I think we do just need one big thing that goes into some factory somewhere and it will get sorted out and then we don't have to think about it.
Okay, thank you very much, Libby.
So I think one of the reasons that we've got so much problem at the moment with recycling and the reason that it's so hard and so complicated is that waste management did start off, regulations did start off exclusively to prevent public health problems and things like that. And recycling was sort of tacked on as an afterthought. And so throughout the EU and in the UK, what you've seen from that is that it's been over-reliant on a single measure to drive action, and that one measure is weight-based recycling targets. And the problem with that is that the only thing that it incentivizes is for people to say that they're able to recycle a portion of material. And because there hasn't been any emphasis on what you should do at the production stage, at the design stage, at the use stage, all that you've been trying to do is push material into the recycling collection system. And as the gentleman's point about incineration bans, the reason we're exporting the materials is actually to meet our recycling targets, which is easier to do abroad because it's more economical to recycle things abroad. And so there's been a lot of perverse outcomes from that, including the fact that there's been no development of domestic reprocessing infrastructure, and we've been heavily reliant on other countries to say that we're able to meet these targets. And what's actually needed is a much more holistic approach. So along the lines that Helen was saying, we need to get all the different people involved who are going to find the systemic, holistic approach to this. And I wish that it was an easy solution. Someone said that, why are we talking about this? It is actually quite complicated, and you need to get lots of different bits right. And if we look at the history of how these problems have developed, we can see that that there might be perverse outcomes if you don't consider things very, very carefully and you promote a solution that's not going to work in the long run.
Okay, thank you very much. And finally, James.
Well, there's one thing quite a lot I don't understand, actually. Gateway, straightway. What's all that gateway stuff about? Can we have a chat about this? I know I'm not in the environmental circle, so I don't know the language, but I have news for you. If you read the International Energy Agency, they say that there's going to be a whole lot more demand for plastics in packaging, clothing, digital devices, medical equipment, detergents, tyres, and that demand is going to be ahead of the demand for plastics in cars, trucks and planes. So we're going to see a whole lot more plastics out there. And then I remind our green friends that plastics are an essential ingredient of solar panels, wind turbine, electric battery, thermal insulation, and electric vehicles. So what we saw with the diesel dilemmas, you've got the same thing with plastic. You really think plastics is shit, then, you know, we must really go back to the cave. It would be a low carbon cave, but it would be a cave all the same. So that's the first point. In fact, the, you know, the religion of the war against plastic, I mean, Dominic, or always is supposed to agree with Dominic, actually, that when he says that we can't see it because it's the new devil, I think that's very true. I mean, it's like fake news or the Russians. It's everywhere, and you don't even know it's there. You know, it's something that we need to be really apprehensive about because we just don't know the outcomes, right? There's, as Donald Rumsfeld said, there's the known, there's the unknown, and then there's the unknown unknowns. What do you know about the unknown unknowns? All you know is you don't know. So, you know, you're going to spend the whole night worrying what could happen, you know. Well, I want to say, if it was that bad, then why is life expectancy throughout the Western and even the Southern parts of the world, until very recently with a few 45-year-olds, why is it increasing? Why is people living longer if we're all being hit by plastics? And why am I feeling fine about eating this fish or what remains of it? Because, you know, I'm confident that we will prevail. And in this war on plastics, we do need a sense of proportion. Now, Libby, you made the point, 8 million tonnes are reaching the oceans. I think you're referring to the UK figure there of plastics. Sorry?
That's the world figure.
That's the world figure. Well, even better. 8 million tonnes. How are you at maths? 8 million is 8 with 6 lots after it, right? The weight of the oceans is 1 with 14 lots after it. So even though you've got, they've got 6 lots, they've got 14 lots. So the incidence of plastics in the oceans is in fact the drop in the ocean. We can solve it technologically. But here I come to the final point, which is what you're suggesting, Helen, and what the gentleman there is suggesting, is we need a nice sort of combination of technological fixes, you make a concession at that moment, plus individual responsibility. But wait a minute, I thought we elected politicians and governments to do the material science research, to clean up our streets, and not for us to go around saying, why aren't you volunteering? So, if I may finish, I think what we're hearing here is that you know, what we had with the useless anti-apartheid movement in Britain, that the sterling struggle through the supermarkets over Outspan oranges would cleanse the world of apartheid. We're now getting this sort of what you call, Helen, bottom-up stuff, where, you know, consumer boycotts, a bit of Twitter, and all the rest of it can solve the problem. No, we need new policies.